This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Dominion, Mastery and Emancipation, Betrayals of Slavery in Speculative Fiction.
So we've gone quite heavy this week.
Yeah, I mean, not that we... Yeah, after the light topics of child abuse and mental health, we decided to tackle something heavy and difficult.
Yeah, we're on a bit of a roll with kind of some of the heavy stuff. I think we're going to have a lighter episode next week, otherwise.
Otherwise it'd be kind of like, what's the point? As we get more and more depressed.
Like, guys, please, take a break! Jules, you were the one who suggested this episode. Do you want to explain where this idea came from?
Yeah, well, like most episodes where I've suggested it, it's happened because Jules got really pissed off about something.
What a shock.
What a shock. Anyone who's been following the latest goings-on of the bookish community will have heard about Emily Wen Zhao's debut novel, Blood Air, and the fact it's, or rather she has pulled it from publication. It was due out in June, due to a big kickoff in the Twitter sphere. And one of the things that it's been accused of is anti-blackness, because she wrote from the perspective of a Chinese immigrant who moved to America when she was 18, and she was writing about the indentured servitude and trafficking that's prevalent in Southeast Asia and parts of China, obviously. This offended a few people who felt that all slavery should be portrayed through an American filter, as far as I can see, and that it was disrespectful to those who had had ancestors who were Black American slaves. There were other things levelled at the book, but I won't go into it. And largely, I think I might not have ever said, hey, let's do an episode about slavery, and the fact that it does crop up, particularly in fantasy, but also in science fiction, time and time again, because that's one of those sort of like, oh God, do I dare touch that as a, basically, I'm a glow-in-the-dark white person. That's how white I am. I really doubt that my ancestors really intermarried out that much. I've got a horrible feeling if I did one of those DNA tests, I'd be like 95% Celtic. There's not a lot of diversity in my background in that respect. But on the other hand, the whole story of slavery is a human story, and it isn't anything really to do with skin colour. It's to do with someone exerting dominion over somebody else, usually through conquest. So it was worth looking at, I felt.
Yeah. I think one of the most important things, and we're going to very quickly have a brief look at the history of slavery. Before we do, it's obviously very important to recognise that in several parts of the world, there has been a huge racial component that has come into it. And when we think of slavery, one of the first things that we in the Western world do think about is the slavery that occurred in America and in the UK as well, which was mostly slavery from people from the African continent who were kidnapped and forced into labour. In different areas. That's the most predominant thing which comes to our mind as Westerners, because it's part of our history. But slavery is a worldwide phenomenon. And depending where you are, there is a different history for what happens. We've had slaveries between many different continents and within continents. It has had large racial components, but it also has been because nothing to do with skin colour or culture or other things like that. Sometimes it's been to do with poverty and just invading as well in general. So why don't we have a quick look at this whole mess?
Yeah, okay. Let's start off with a little lesson in etymology, because I'm a word nerd and I like to inflict these things on you all. So, the origins of the word slave. Slave is a Middle English word, which we derived from the Old French word sclava, and which was in turn derived from the medieval Latin word sclavus, or slave. This is literally a word that was used to describe the Slavic people. We call them the Slavs and the Slavic people because we conquered them over and over again in the Middle Ages. I don't just mean the British or the English. The Europeans in general kind of all conquered them and took them away as slaves, to the point where there is a word in Dutch and German and Spanish and Italian which literally comes from the same root word, which means slave, but generally its etymology is that it's referring to this specific group of people. There's no actual skin colour component in this whatsoever. This is white people doing shitty things to white people. So, as a little fun aside, back during the Middle Ages, the Italians even had a little phrase where when they were saying goodbye, they were being very formal and very serious. And, you know, we might say at your service, madam, over here, you know, in the Victorian era, if you're a bit of a prat. Or, you know, you might say it now if you're a bit of a prat. At your service, or I am your humble servant.
Servant, ma'am.
Exactly. Now, during the Middle Ages, the Italians had a phrase that went "sono vostro schiavo," which means "I am your slave." You know, I sincerely grant you my service, but you're basically literally declaring your enslavement to this person that you're taking your leave from. And then they got a little bit lazy, so they, instead of saying "sono vostro schiavo," they said "schiavo," as in slave. So to say goodbye, they went "slave," as in "I am your slave." And then that got even more truncated and they just said ciao. And then the Italians decided to get involved in the Second World War. And during the time of the Second World War, Italy was occupied by the American troops. And they picked up the word ciao and brought it back to England and to America, where they thought this was a really exotic way of saying goodbye. But every time you say ciao to somebody, what you're really saying is, I am your slave.
Wow. Okay.
So the word, you know, it's funny and it's tragic at the same time. It just shows that the evolution of language. But it would be, my point here is, it would be impossible to say that the word slave originated with one specific, admittedly horrific set of events, which involved mostly black African people being imported into America, because the word dates back a good sort of 800 years more than that. In fact, slavery dates back, in fact, it predates the written word. It predates written history. Every culture at some point has indulged in enslaving another.
Yeah. And the first real examples of slavery that, well, I mean, that's probably even before that. We have examples, you know, written, I say written, you know, recorded examples of slavery with the Vikings.
Yeah. In the Bible.
In the Bible, yeah. Before it was really kind of everybody
the
else.
Greeks,
it was,
the Romans,
it was just,
the Egyptians, yeah. The Chinese.
Everybody, all enslaving one another. I mean, there was a thing in, it's also, you know, there's an element to do with class as well, which is that you could be enslaved if you weren't protected by a title, weren't protected by a certain family. I mean, in Japanese history, for instance, people of lower classes didn't even have names.
Yeah.
During certain periods in history, they didn't even have names. They were referred to by a quality they might have or the job that they had. So it would just be boy or cook or things like that. You know, that's just one level up. It was about, you know, the stripping of identity, the fact that these people weren't even recognized as fully human, not on the same level. So we have examples of that throughout history in all cultures. I know it's not exactly the same, but when you're talking about the Italian word, all I was thinking about was the fact that it is very common as well in other languages to prostrate yourself as a servant or a slave or to, when referring to someone else, refer to them as higher than you are.
Yes.
For instance, monsieur in French is monsieur, and sieur is means sir.
Yeah.
And I think that it comes from seigneur, which is what we also call monseigneur, is sometimes how we refer to God.
Yeah.
Like, it's it all kind of piles down from that long history of hierarchy, and slavery was one level on that hierarchy, and it was actually informed by that as well. And then, of course, what happened was that we got better at traveling further afield, and so rather than enslaving our own people,
we enslaved people who looked just different enough that we could say it's okay.
Yeah.
Let's agree to a definition of slavery, and then I just want to talk very briefly about Persia and about Greece.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when, as you rightly said at the beginning, Madeline, when you say slave to somebody in Western society, usually what they have in their mind is the American African slavery. Understandably, part of the reason that we think that is because of the work done by abolitionists like William Wilberforce, because it was so well documented. I don't think there was another period in history where slavery was quite so well documented and put in the public view to garner sympathy and support for the movement. And it was a good thing, a really good thing. We learned about it in school, and I remember it being utterly horrifying, and I still find it horrifying to this day. And every time I find out more about it, I am still horrified, as you should be.
Yeah.
However, slavery doesn't just refer to that. Slavery can refer to any situation where an individual is de facto forced to work against their own will. And this includes unfree labour, forced labour, indentured servitude, or debt bondage. It can also include human trafficking. It can include child soldiers. It can include forced marriage and abduction marriages. Some of which may, you know, if you look into the statistics of some of those latter things which are still happening today, it's utterly heartbreaking. There's an estimated 40.3 million people in slavery or situations of slavery in the world today.
Yeah.
This isn't something that just happened in the past. And if you want to look at child soldiers, there's an estimated between 200 and 300,000 child soldiers being used in various intercultural type wars. The actual slave trade itself is still, believe it or not, alive and doing pretty well. It's quite lucrative.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It doesn't really pay a great deal of attention to skin colour. It's about whether somebody's useful. A big part of that, they reckon about 40% of that, is the sex trafficking industry. And that makes up something like 45% of the profits of the entire slave trade in modern day. And then there's 69% of the marriages in, say, Ethiopia seem to be abduction marriages, which is forced marriage. And again, that is a form of slavery.
Mm.
So what I'm getting at here is that, well, what happened? The well-documented importation of slaves from Africa to the United States and places like Barbados, etc., is terrible. It was a uniquely horrible thing, but this does not blot out all the uniquely horrible things that are currently going on now. So when somebody gets up on their high horse about it, yes, they're absolutely right to be sensitive about the issue. To attack an author of colour, to attack a woman of colour who is deliberately trying to make a commentary on current-day slavery practices, because that's what she was talking about, with the insistence that it can only be looked at through an American filter, and that if you haven't taken that into account, then you're being insensitive, is really quite disturbing.
Yeah.
Because it means so much more than just this particular episode. Nobody is saying that that episode in history shouldn't have left racial scarring. You know, it did, and it was terrible. And it is something that we should feel uncomfortable about and still look at anyway. But I don't understand how you can be so focused on that you're then not interested in the plight of those people who are actually currently enslaved, I guess.
I think it's a complicated issue with this. And I haven't read the book. I read, you know, some of the... I at least read the author's response, you know, when she pulled it. And... you know, she feels that her work, she doesn't want her work to offend people who she wants to hold up. And I think probably The problem came with the fact that it was marketed obviously towards an American, it was being sold in America, which has this history. There was also the treatment of a black character within the book itself. As I said, I don't know the details. I haven't read the book, so I'm just coming at this almost completely blind. What I do know is that the author, you know, herself pulled it, and she recognised the complaints. So I think there's two sides to it, but I do also think that there may have been a slightly targeted attack side to that. And I think that you're right, Jules. We need to recognize as Westerners that our experience is not the only experience. And so when I say our experience, I'm not saying that my family ever had to, well, in all likelihood, my fact that, you know, the only kind of slavery or discrimination that at least my British family had to endure was when we were still in Ireland, from the Brits, oddly enough.
yeah, but they get everywhere.
Yeah, but our history, you know, it's not the universal history. It is not the only history, and we are absolutely right to pay attention to it and to still be affected by it. But I think if we narrow our view to only see that particular side of slavery, if I say, oh, that is the only kind of slavery that there ever was, that was the worst period of slavery, first of all, actually, I don't think that's healthy, because it was a horrific period of time. And as you say, same with me, Jules, it still makes me feel totally sick, and it should, and it always will. In the same level that it's no less important or no more important than other forms of slavery which happened through history and continue to happen now. And when we limit our view of these things, that's actually the beginning of the end, when it, in terms of you know, tolerance, and also in terms of learning and improving and making things better.
Yeah, absolutely. Just as an aside, I know a little bit more about the book, so I actually received an ARC, which I've started reading.
Okay.
The so-called The Death of the Black Character, I've not actually got to it yet, but she's not actually described as black. She's described as having bronze skin and green eyes. So she, while people have argued that she's black coded, you could also argue that she isn't, just as strongly, in my opinion. I'm not going to go into the politics, shall we say, of certain authors who seem to have taken a particular interest in tearing this particular young adult author down, but I find the entire situation highly suspect. So, anyway, back to slavery and Persia. Mm. There's an interesting aside here, and I don't want anybody to think I'm saying that slavery is in any way good, because it's not. Any way that you have your freedom taken and restricted. And if you're not free to not do something, then you're basically, you're not free to do it either.
Yeah.
Nobody should be enslaved, period, full stop. However, there were times in history where you could be a slave and you could actually be economically and physically better off than the common person. That's not going to be a popular thing for most people to hear, but in Persia, if you were enslaved to the right household, you tended to be quite well looked after, whereas the common person didn't know where the next meal was coming from. For example, in ancient Greece, if you were a skilled person who was enslaved, like a lot of slaves who were well educated became tutors to the young men of the family and had very trusted positions, to the point where several of them, when their masters or mistresses died and they were freed as part of the will, so they weren't just sent on to someone else, then went and sold themselves again into slavery to another family because that was the position they were comfortable with. Now, without getting into the whole well, you know, by that point they'd internalized this mentality whereby they had to serve a master or a mistress, which I'm sure there is an element of that too.
Yeah.
It's not, once again, we have to challenge the perception that all types of slavery are exactly the same, because while having your freedom taken is appalling, at the same time, you know what, I'm going to use an example. What I was saying just now about the whole, I can't understand how people who are sensitive about slavery are not just as concerned with current slavery.
Mm.
Because I personally think that would be like me being really upset about the Great Famine, the Irish potato famine, which wasn't really a famine at all, and being really angry about it, which I still am. To this day, if you want to get me ranting, start talking about the potato famine, and use the word potato famine specifically, because that'll do it. And that would be like me then not caring about people starving to death in other countries, or in our own country, not caring about homeless people here, which I do. So, you know, the two things, one set of suffering doesn't mean that I therefore get a free pass on being blind to other people's suffering, ultimately.
Yeah. And I also think it's important, yeah, it's also, you know, recognizing that suffering from your own history or your own people is not more important. It may be closer to home, but it's not more important than the suffering of people in other cultures, because that's all part of the same mentality, yeah, which meant that other cultures were considered less than and could be enslaved. Not that, okay, that came out wrong. That makes it sound like I'm saying you're as bad as slavers. I'm not. I'm saying that if we start to allow that separation, that's a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we're going to say we only care when it's our own people, then that's a really huge issue right there.
Yeah.
We obviously know that the situation in America was desperate. It was dreadful.
Yeah. And not only was it desperate and dreadful, it has set a precedent which is still affecting people of colour and Black Americans to this day. And I think that's important to recognise.
Yeah.
You know, that this history of slavery is still a huge part of the problematic culture which is happening now, which is probably and very reasonably why it's such a sensitive and difficult topic to approach, because this is something which is still affecting people today. So
yeah.
I can really, really appreciate that. And again, I'm very conscious of the fact that we are two white, but English, single. Well, I say English, I mean, we're two white Europeans, you know. From the British Isles, and both of us have history from indentured countries such as Ireland, but, you know, we are still coming from a position of privilege. I really hope that anyone who's listening understands. We don't mean to offend. We are 100% always here to listen and to hear new ideas and to be disagreed with and to learn. This is just us trying to sort out this information. So
yeah. And not to bang on about the famine, but I suppose what I'm saying is I can see the perspective of having this racial scarring on your memory.
Yeah.
Because that still, I mean, I say I get angry about it, but it's more than that. It's something that goes much, much deeper, and it's very difficult to conceptualize into words.
Mm. Yeah.
Right, so once that, having done a sort of very whistle stop tour through slavery, which, you know, we cannot do justice to a subject that is so huge in historical terms, but
yeah,
we've established it's happened everywhere. If there's one thing human beings are good at, it's coming up with new ways to be shitty to each other.
Yes, and we are all very, very shitty to one another.
But it's something that is kind of rich fodder for exploration, particularly in speculative fiction.
Mm.
Speculative fiction can give you the distance, as we've said before, to examine difficult subjects with less in the way of immediate consequences, in the sense of it, you know, it gives you some distance so you can really look at different facets of difficult things.
Yeah. I think one of the things about when we portray slavery in fiction is that because it does have such a long history and is still prevalent today, much to my horror, there's no way that you can bring the topic up without at least kind of drawing on or referencing, or intentionally or not, something which has happened or is happening in one way or another, no matter how you kind of portray it, which can be quite risky, even if you do your research.
Yeah, definitely. That's obviously where Zhao has kind of fallen down a little bit. I don't think she was wrong to just want to come at it from a Southeast Asian or Chinese perspective to talk about indenture rather than you know, American slavery.
Yeah, but there have been examples, for instance, where people you have a trope which is the a slave falling in love with their master trope, which has occurred in fiction a few times.
Is that things like The Winner's Curse, which I've never actually read, in fairness?
I don't know, because I have not read it either. But I have seen examples or heard of examples of this trope. And I think it's coming from a place of well-meaning, in that you're like, I want to tell this story about someone who's in a desperate situation and this power struggle and things like that. And that's coming from someone who hasn't really stopped to think about the implication of what they're writing. And I think that when you are handling difficult topics like that, which are still so alive today, it's important to recognize the implication of what you are writing. It's important to recognize that pairing someone with their abuser is potentially damaging, and it's potentially sending out the wrong information, and it might even romanticize an idea which doesn't really deserve to be romanticized. I can't believe I have to say this, but romanticizing slavery is probably a tiny bit of a no-no. Like, maybe no, don't do that.
That is a no-go. I mean, let's be clear here. When the Romans obviously made a big thing, they had a massive, massive slave trade that went on much, much longer. Mm. And, you know, anybody who was conquered was fair game to be slavery. It had nothing to do with skin colour. There was definitely a market for exotics, as they would have put it.
Yes.
But the exotics for the Roman Empire would have been the Angles. So basically the pre-English with their golden hair and blue eyes, as well as people from places like Africa, etc. So it really depends where you are in history. Now, the Romans did sometimes free, you know, slaves could earn their freedom to a certain extent. The Romans did marry some of their slaves.
Yeah, the Roman slave trade was quite strange.
Yes.
Because there was still a place to go, if that makes sense. Earning freedom, you know, gaining respect, being put in positions of authority even, this was still possible. Now, I'm not saying it was good. Slavery is never good. But it was a slightly different situation from, say, slavery in the Americas.
Yeah,
where there was no chance, you know, that the chance of embetterment, improvement, anything like that of your situation was very, very difficult. Whereas for Rome, part of what made their empire so successful was the fact that anyone could really become a Roman citizen.
Yeah, this is true.
And you could, you know, and so you did have free slaves, and you did have slaves in positions of power, and slaves who were treated well, slaves who might have even found themselves in a better situation than they were in originally, you know, from where they were taken. And again, slavery is a big no-no. I cannot begin to emphasize how much that is the case. But there were definitely situations whereby someone would be taken from severe poverty. And again, this was especially true of people rather than from African nations and countries. White Angles and Celts who were taken from poverty or from bad situations, and were then actually put in situations where they were fed regularly, where they could bathe, where they were where they might have even been treated well, where they could marry, where they could have children, where they could actually potentially earn their freedom, and they might even be able to be educated. There was opportunity still. There was the potential of opportunity. So slavery was was successful, possibly, in the Roman Empire, mostly because actually there was a chance of happiness, but there were still uprisings. And the whole thing with Spartacus, I think, is a very fine example of the fact that slavery is never a good thing, and that, oddly enough, people aren't particularly happy with it in general.
No, it's worth pointing out, as you say, obviously, as we've mentioned, that the Romans, the Greeks, I think even biblical slavery as well, the Vikings, the Saxons with their serfs and what have you, all of those could actually potentially earn their freedom. And it's worth mentioning, certainly with the Saxons, after the advent of the Dane law, the serfs were protected. You couldn't rape them, you couldn't mistreat them. There were definite laws in place to actually protect them.
Yeah,
laws sometimes fail.
Yeah,
but they were quite strict about this, and there were hefty fines if you broke any of these things. Fines that were paid not to the master or mistress, but to the serfs themselves.
Yeah.
Again, not advocating for slavery, just pointing out that there's many, many different levels here.
Yeah.
I will say, because I don't think we've really encapsulated this yet, that chattel slavery, whereby you treat a person under the property laws, was really only institutionalized in America. And perhaps that's what makes slavery in made the American slavery so uniquely awful.
Yeah.
Was the fact that that was the first time people were really definitely considered property and were applied as property under property law.
Yeah, it's just so mind-bogglingly horrific. I can't even. I don't think that you could study it for years and you still couldn't the tail comprehend. Yeah, the magnitude of how horrific it was. And yeah, the idea of people owning other people, it just makes me physically sick. It really does.
Yeah. Anyway, we're supposed to be talking about it in spec fiction.
So we are.
Let's spend the next 20 minutes sort of looking at examples of speculative fiction. And we've already sort of touched on The Winner's Curse, even though neither of us have read it. The whole idea of, you know, romanticising the slave falls in love with the mistress falls in love with the slave, etc., etc. That's massively uncomfortable, but we can't comment on that book any further because neither of us have read it. So yeah. Let's look at some of the others.
Yes. Let's start with slaves who are indentured. Now, Leah Bardugo managed to cover slavery in a very interesting way in her Grisha series, and in you particularly see it in Six of Crows and Crooked Kingdom. And in doing so, she really actually made an observation about modern slavery and the way that people are getting away with it nowadays, whereby slavery is actually illegal in Ketterdam. You are not allowed to keep slaves. But people get around this by creating these contracts, which are particularly targeted toward Grisha, who are often in desperate situations. So Grisha, for those who haven't read Six of Crows, these are people who possess magical capabilities. And they've been kind of chased out of their homeland. There's a revolution going on, and they are in a danger of being taken by pirates or kidnapped or killed or snatched up or enslaved. So the only way for them to be protected is if they are working for somebody. So what happens is that they get put into these contracts, which they can never actually get out of.
Yeah, it's classic debt bondage, whereby you... how it tends to happen, shall we take Asia for an example, you desperately need to feed your family. There is no way for you to get money to buy food or to pay for your rent or whatever. So you go for a loan. And you're so desperate, you take the loan. And as surety, you put yourself, your ability to work for this person who's provided the loan up, because you have nothing else. You don't have a house. You don't own anything valuable enough to use as surety against the loan. The loan interest is usually so huge that you can never, ever pay it off. And as soon as you fall behind, which happens pretty quickly, that's it. You're taken into debt bondage or indentured servitude. So, yeah, it's a neat way of getting around the whole, slavery is illegal thing.
Yeah. And, you know, certain tactics are used to keep you in debt as well. Tactics such as the fact that you have to stay on site, but you have to pay for your room on site.
Yeah.
So you're charged for that. You're charged for the food that you consume. You know, you have expenses that are put on you, and you may even have expenses falsely put on you or be forced to have these expenses put on you. And there's literally, you know, these are all schemes that are put in place that never let you out. And I think it's probably worth mentioning that this kind of thing happens in American prisons.
Yeah.
And the American prison system is just mind-bogglingly horrific. They actually make a joke about it in Thor Ragnarok with the whole the slaves are escaping. I don't like that word. Sorry, I mean the prisoners with jobs are escaping.
Yes.
And I just thought, oh, shots fired. That was very good. Whereby you have these privatized prisons where prisoners are put to work. They earn an absolute pittance. They also actually have to pay to be in jail or something like that.
Yeah, for their keep.
So they can actually come out of prison in more debt than they went in. Putting them in an endlessly hopeless situation whereby they've come out of prison, they have more debt, it's incredibly difficult for them to get a job. They are put into a situation whereby they're more likely to commit a crime again in order to survive. So they end up back in prison where the horrific cycle continues. And not to mention the fact that, of course, that there is a quota for how many people need to be imprisoned to keep these prisons running, because they're businesses. So you have the most vulnerable people in society, and you have minorities who are targeted. And here we are again. Basically, you know, people of colour are the most targeted minority when it comes to this. So we have an example of black slavery still happening in the US, disguised as legal in a country where slavery is illegal. And so I love the way Leah Bardugo brings light to that by saying this is what's happening, and it's a desperate situation and you can't escape from it. And the way that, even as a joke, they looked at that dynamic in Thor Ragnarok, saying this is what's happening and it's real and it is a form of slavery.
And I haven't got very far through my advanced review copy of Blood Air yet, but
right.
So I can't comment much further than that. But the whole indentured is almost a prime example of exactly the same thing.
So yes, so that's definitely one way that it's done, and I think the way also Leigh Bardugo does it is that it doesn't just happen with the Grisha. You also have examples of actual slaves happening. So you have the character of Inej. She is a slave. She was captured.
Abducted and sold, and basically trafficked.
Yeah, she was trafficked into the sex trade. But it's all appears above board. because this is a girl who was, you know, pressured and forced to sign these papers, was too scared, was traumatized, and was put in a situation where she couldn't escape. And the sex trade is still very much alive, and sex trafficking and sex slavery is still very much alive in places where the sex trade is legal. And I think that's something, you know, we advocate free sex trade in places like Holland, for instance, where we're saying it's great. People who want to be prostitutes can be prostitutes. This is an industry. Okay. And I'm all for that. I'm all for basically saying, no, this should not be made illegal. Because actually it's much safer if it isn't.
Yep.
But actually, regardless of whether it's legal or not, there are still cases of people who are being kidnapped or being tricked into it and being forced into situations which they can't escape and are being made into sex slaves. That is something which is a reality. And actually, because it's legal, that presents new and difficult problems in actually preventing this kind of slavery, because these victims are so traumatized and they are put in such desperate situations that they can't report what's happening, that they're being made to lie, so they can't escape. And so I thought that it was brilliant that Leigh Bardugo managed to cover such a sensitive and enormous subject so successfully, and have so many examples of slavery all set in a city where slavery is illegal.
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to talk about the Trickster duology by Tamora Pierce, where she has come from a position of being, I don't want to say traditional slavery, but you know, the more, as you would envisage it, somebody being abducted. Now, Eileen is a white character, very definitely, and in the grand tradition of the Cornish pirates, she's out sailing her little boat one day off the coast where her, you know, her parents' castle is. Yep. She decides to sail around to the next cove because she's trying to avoid her mother, and she gets picked up by a pirate ship who are like, yeah, great, we don't care what colour your skin is, we'll happily sell you over to the Copper Islands. So yeah, she's sold as a slave over there. The Copper Islands are kind of like a version of various parts of India in our world. And obviously there are slaves of all colours, creeds, denominations. And it turns out that for Eileen, it kind of works out. She goes in with more training and understanding than probably most people. Her father's kind of trained her as a proto-spy, even though he won't let her work as a spy.
Right.
So she already goes in knowing how to get out of a lot of situations. She's already armed for it. And in the end, she's one of the key players behind the uprising of the Copper Islands and the overthrowing of the white masters, as it were.
Yeah.
It's not quite a white saviour narrative, but I reckon it probably wouldn't be published in the same way today as it was sort of 12 years ago, which is when it came out.
Yeah.
And it is interesting. It is. They are good books and they are worth looking at. She's certainly not the only person who does any good there, and she never ends up ruling or anything like that. She's just very good at masterminding the spycraft behind it. Being enslaved is the way of getting her from one place to another, and there are gods involved as well, who are basically Kyprioth, the trickster god, wants the Copper Islands back.
Right.
So he kind of engineered the whole her getting kidnapped and sold into slavery thing. But yeah, it's kind of done right in some ways and kind of done less sensitively in others. But then a lot of that sort of less sensitive side of things really comes in because it's things that have been raised in the last sort of 12 years. I don't think that things like The Winner's Curse would get published now, for example.
Yeah.
And you know, the whole sort of, we mentioned somebody who's enslaved or indentured falling in love with their master. Well, Kaz Brekker bought Inej's contract, and then she did start to develop feelings for him.
Yes.
It's done quite well, but at the same time, there's an initial sort of, oh, squicky knee-jerk moment there too.
I think the difference is that Kaz Brekker buys her, but he doesn't. This is gonna sound wrong. He doesn't technically own her. Kaz kind of she's the one who approaches him. She's the one who says, "Let me come with you. I can be useful to you." So there is an element of there's less kind of control there, if that makes sense. They are more on even footing. They are both kind of in the same position. They're both sort of owned by the dregs. And it's definitely the hold on a second. Are we going for that narrative now? But it is a little bit different from the very obvious. Well, I've been enslaved, but this master is not quite as cruel as the others. In fact, he treats me kindly. I shall fall in love with him, for he is only misunderstood. And I'm like, yeah, but he still owns you, right?
It's quite difficult. It's the kind of the pretty woman thing, isn't it? Whereby you've got someone who was in a life that they didn't like that was kind of slowly killing them emotionally.
Yeah. I think another example actually of that, which I mean, I loved these books as a kid, and I've talked about them before. Caroline Lawrence's The Roman Mysteries. And Caroline Lawrence is great. She's had a she for rep for representation in books back then as well. I mean, this was, you know, about sort of about 15 years ago now. When the series started, her four main characters, the boss is a girl named Flavia. She's a Roman. She comes from a good family. Her neighbor is a Jewish boy named Jonathan. They befriend a Greek street urchin named Lupus, who is disabled. He's had his tongue cut out, so he's mute. And Flavia buys a slave girl who introduces herself as Nubia, because that's what they were told to all call each other, and then decides to stick with the name Nubia, even though she does have you know, she eventually reveals that that was not obviously the name that she was born with. And potentially now you look at it and you go, oh, okay, hold on, that's a bit odd, you know, they befriend each other. But when you look at it with the context of the book, what happens again? This is the Roman Empire. Flavia has uncovered a kind of a little treasure trove in a magpie's nest, and so she's going. It's her birthday. She's going to go get a gift, and as she's going into town with her father, she spots this slaver with this group of slaves, and right at the end is Nubia, and Nubia is her age. And Flavia is just so struck by the sight of this girl, and so she says to her father, can we get her, because she wants to save her from what's happening. And they do, they manage to save her, and she's never really treated as a servant. But actually Caroline Lawrence has a whole narrative about slavery, which is very important. To the point that Flavia doesn't even kind of really realize the whole issue about slaves, because she's so, you know, she's brought up in it. It's just the structure that she was raised in, that she doesn't even think about the fact that she technically still owns Nubia until the moment a few books later when she frees her, as in she officially frees her. And this only really comes around when they spend time with another Roman noble, who Nubia has a dog, and this Roman noble just takes the dog. And Jonathan is like, that dog doesn't belong to you. And she goes, don't be silly, slaves can't own things. And they have this kind of this sudden, and also at one point, Flavia also gets captured by slavers. And she's like, but I'm an official Roman citizen. I'm Roman. And it's this kind of, there's this gentle kind of realization of for her, and Caroline Lawrence is always very 100% straight. Slavery is not good. but she kind of looks at how you can be indoctrinated into overlooking certain things, which I think is actually really important, because that's kind of what we do now. We're indoctrinated into overlooking certain things and situations of injustice because it's so common to us. And actually all it takes is a moment to really take a step back and to see things in action for us to realize. And this indoctrination is why we still have slavery today. Because we say, okay, but it's not as bad as it could have been. Look at how things were back then. Nubia was tied up. She was going to be, you know, anything could have happened to her. And now she lives in comfort. You know, we're best friends. She eats well. So, of course, Flavia never thinks, hold on a second, I still own her.
Yeah.
And just in the same way now that we say, oh, but, you know, you have people, they're not working in plantations, you know, they do something wrong, they end up in prison. Yeah, they should work. They should provide for the economy, until you go, hold on a second. We've manufactured a situation which is totally hopeless for people, which is criminalizing them and forcing them into labor. So in that way, I think it's actually very good. In other ways, I think that things probably have to be a little bit different now, or the message would have to be even clearer if the books were being published today.
Yeah, definitely. When we came up with this episode, the other one that sort of kind of sprung to mind was The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, which touches very briefly on slavery. If you've read The Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis, you know that...
Christian propaganda.
It's more than that. To be honest, having reread The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe at Christmas, I'm like, actually, even the Christian side of this isn't that heavy-handed. You can choose to read it as a fantasy novel if you want to. There's a big rift between sort of Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and Prince Caspian. Prince Caspian should have been on the throne. The whole book about Prince Caspian is about putting Prince Caspian back on the throne. And then
good for you, Prince Caspian.
The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, having established his rule in Narnia, he decides to take a tour of the Lone Islands, which are part of the Narnian kingdom, but which have lost touch with the rulership of Narnia. And they are naturally horrified to discover that slavery is being practiced in the Lone Islands, particularly since they discover this by being captured by slavers and sold into slavery.
Yep, I can definitely see why that would be uncomfortable for Caspian.
It's not, considering the time it was written, which is, you know, back in the 50s, and considering who wrote it, rather stuffy white male middle-aged bachelor, I think it does still hold up for young children today to say, you know, look, this happens and this is appalling. Where it falls down a bit is that obviously everybody sold into slavery there is either like a talking animal or a dwarf or a white person, as so many of C.S. Lewis's characters are, on all counts, in fact. But I certainly remember encountering it as a sort of 7-year-old and being horrified, because that might have been one of the first times I really encountered what slavery was. Certainly in literature. I'm really not seeing much of it in film either. You know, it's going back quite a long time. This is going back to something like, the only other time I would have heard of it would have been reading the Bible. And I did read the Bible, several versions, from cover to cover as a child, because I was expected to. So the only other time I would have come across it would have been in the story of Joseph and his amazing coat. And the fact that his own brothers sold him into slavery to the Egyptians.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Moses and the freeing of the Israelites, etc., etc. So, you know, I'd have encountered it, but that was the first time I'd have encountered it in a children's book.
Yeah. Sorry, I just suddenly... It's really funny to me, the whole kind of... yes, and Joseph was sold into slavery, and this was very bad, despite the fact, right, that his father Jacob had several slaves, including two of the women that he kind of got as add-ons to his two wives.
Yeah, they do skate over that rather.
Because they're like, he had lots of kids, and I'm like, not from just the two women, right? He had two slaves as well. two slave wives who kind of just got added in as an extra. Like, But yeah, let's just forget the rampant slavery which exists in the Bible. Yeah, I think probably the first examples of slavery for me, other than Joseph and the Israelites in Egypt, I think probably one of the most prominent examples of slavery for me in a book that I read was from The Slaves of the Mastery, which is by an author named William Nicholson. And The Slaves of the Mastery is the second book in
Is it the wind?
the Wind on Fire
Yeah.
trilogy. And actually, The Slaves of the Mastery makes a really good commentary on slavery, but also corporate kind of slavery. And industrial slavery, because what happens is basically the main characters, Kestrel and Bowman, their city gets attacked by an invading army, and they're all enslaved. A lot of people are murdered, and they're all enslaved, and they get brought to a city called the Mastery, and they quickly realize that everyone in the Mastery is a slave, all except for the master at the top. But there are different levels of slave, and you can work your way up. But they are all slaves. And it's really interesting because you suddenly say, okay, so what is a slave in this sense? And the slave is that none of them can leave. They have to work, but actually, several of them find work that they enjoy. Several of them, find fulfillment. They can get married. They can, live comfortably and happily and have luxuries, and they can earn and continue, and they can go all the way up to the top. The only person they can't get more powerful than is obviously the master himself. And they're all slaves, but their structure is basically just like a modern working industrial structure that we have nowadays.
Yeah, you can't exist outside the system.
Yeah, you can't exist outside of the system. Capitalism, you can't escape capitalism, not easily. And unlike, within the Slaves of the Mastery, one of the things he does to control them is that at first, as they're kind of being kind of indoctrinated into the system, half of them are kept in cages. And the other half get to work, and then they kind of swap around. And if anyone misbehaves, the cages are all set on fire.
Yeah.
That's obviously not something which happens very often in Western culture. But there is still definitely this commentary on the fact that actually we are all kind of, we exist within structures which are controlled by the 1%. And no matter what we try and do, we have freedom of speech, we have the ability to move, we have the ability to, to protest and to contest and things like that. We are still being controlled. Our entire society is controlled by a tiny, tiny percent of people who are obscenely rich,
Yeah.
and they manage everything, and I think that was a good metaphor. Whether it was intentional or not, it's worth noting.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I read that trilogy, but I remember not liking it as much, probably because I read it right after His Dark Materials, and it didn't
Ah,
hold
right.
up quite as well for me. But yeah, I think it probably was an intentional message. And yeah, it does make that good point. I think what we're coming to here is the fact that we need these representations of different types of indenture and slavery in speculative fiction. And we need all of them.
Yeah.
We need them there because seeing them in speculative fiction helps us recognize them in real life, even when they're heavily disguised by being legal in another form, as we've already discussed.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I want to see things that sensitively portray the plight of the African American slave institution.
Yeah, and that don't romanticize it in any way.
And don't romanticize it. I want to see portrayals of slavery where it's a bit more confusing as well. You know, they're rehashing the Roman Empire or the Persian Empire. I want to see portrayals of modern day indenture in speculative fiction as well, of varying types.
Yeah,
and it can be done.
Yeah, it can be done, and it can be done very successfully. I think it all comes down to research, and to a level of sensitivity, and an ability to separate certain things. I'm gonna admit something. This makes me terrified, because actually slavery is something I touch on in one of the YA books that I'm writing.
Yeah.
And I'm so scared, because I've done my absolute best to represent this with, you know, sensitivity, and I've done my research, and, you know, I've tried, and I think that there will still be several layers of making sure that this is not going to upset anyone, or that this is not going to send out the wrong message. But I kind of decided to go for a similar sort of situation whereby slavery is not the country that I exist in. It's heavily inspired by ancient Egypt.
Yeah.
In that this is a desert society which exists on a delta. They're very rich, and they're multicultural. There are two main people who live there. You have the Niobe, and the Niobe were the original people who lived on the delta. It's their land. It's that they lived on the river, basically. And what happened was that an invading force called the Nkwambi arrived, and kind of just set up shop. And the Nkwambi built up a society which is quite racially pushes the Niobe down, so gives them few opportunities to rise up. This has obviously happened several times throughout history, particularly the British arriving and just saying, this is a nice place, I guess we'll have it.
Do you have a flag?
Do you have a flag? No flag, no country. Those are the rules that I just made up. Thank you, Mr. Eddie Izzard. So this is an example, first of all, of one level of slavery whereby the Niobe are free. But what happened was that the Nkwambi arrived. They basically said, this land is ours. You can continue to work it, but you work it for us now. The Nkwambi separated their city into different circles. So you have the grain circle, which is the majority of where the Niobe lived, because that was already where they were living. It's where their villagers were. And it's where all of the farmland is. And these were an agricultural people who lived on agriculture and on fishing from the river. So they are pushed into the situation where it's very difficult for them to elevate themselves or to succeed within this society that the Nkwambi have very purposefully built to exclude them. So we have one level of kind of slavery there. But they don't have slaves. Everybody is paid. Everybody is free. You can go. You can come back. You can't enter certain levels of the city unless you have kind of permits or, you know, things like that, because there are different sort of security levels. So the main circle is just for the royals and things like that. Then what happens is they discover a magical people who they call the Mwari. And the Mwari, no one knows where the Mwari Island are. A Mwari Island is. All they know is that one day a Mwari showed up with a boat, and it was full of gold and jewels and things like that. And they're like, wow, these people have incredible wealth, but also they look very different to us. And the Nkwambi and the Niobe have very different kind of features already, but the Mwari are magical. and they have kind of like a that they have a relationship with the sea. They're kind of like mermaids, basically. And what happens is that every time a Mwari is seen, because they're so rare, it's only very occasional that a Mwari will get lost and will accidentally get picked up. The Mwari are kind of taken and they're used as exhibitions. So they're not slaves, but they can't leave. They're kind of treated as exotic animals. And there've only been a few Mwari in Kemet, and the story centers around one such Mwari who was basically raped by she was kind of used as a sex slave by the emperor and his people, and so she had a son who is free. He's not a slave, but he's not allowed to leave Kemet. He has to stay. So he can move around it, but he can't leave. And he's always very conscious of the fact that at any moment someone could say, "No, actually, you're too valuable. We're just going to lock you up in the same room that we locked your mother up in, which is this beautiful gilded cage." But fortunately for this boy, there is another Mwari, a full Mwari, who is currently in that position. And the whole story basically is that she escapes and that they basically go, "Right, screw it, let's go home." And they begin this journey to go and find the Mwari Island. But I'm very nervous about it because obviously we have a history, especially in Britain, of going over to other cultures and saying, "Wow, you look different to us. How exotic. Come with us." And putting people in literal zoos. So it's been a journey to write this, and I don't know if it'll ever get see the light of day. I don't know if I've said too much now. I don't know if I've just been
No,
ranting on.
I don't think so. Obviously, I haven't read the entire thing, but I've read bits of it, and it's not a simple, straight up. This is these people are enslaved, these people are on top, etc., etc. It's much more nuanced than that, which, in most cases, it is true. And this is going back to what I was saying. We need all these different versions to be represented in speculative fiction, in my opinion, because we need people to know that these things are still going on. So many people don't realize this. So many people don't realize that in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, people are still being sold between tribes as slaves and as child brides and as child soldiers, etc. You can't solve a problem without being aware of it. You can't do anything about this terrible debt bondage indenture culture in Asia and in other places without knowing it's there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think we've run out of time.
We've even overshot a little bit, but it's a huge, huge topic. We've done our best to be sensitive, but at the same time, not pull punches where we felt it wasn't necessary.
However, if any of our listeners have anything to say or they disagree with us, we are very open to hearing what you have to say and to learning more. So please leave us a comment, send us a message. We are, yeah, th this is such a huge topic, and there are just so many different things and so many different sides that we can't possibly touch on them all this episode. So yeah, leave us a comment, let us know what you think. Sorry for going on and on about this this book. Before we go, it's time for our Dissecting Dragons. Sorry, I just kind of had a brain moment. I can't talk. Hold on a second. Sorry. It's time for our recommendation of the week. And this week, I've got one for you. And I am going to recommend Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency.
Is that the new? I say the new. Is that the American version?
It's the American version. It's got Elijah Wood in it. And I have been very unwell the last few weeks, so I've blitzed through series one and two. Unfortunately, it has been cancelled, so I was very worried about whether it was going to be satisfactory, the end, or whether it was going to leave on a cliffhanger. I was glad to say that season two ended in a satisfactory way. There was potential for more, but it didn't feel kind of annoyingly open-ended. And I really love this series, and it's amazing because I almost gave up on it after episode three, because I hate things which are just overly confusing and then continue to be confusing, and you never get any answers and there's never any proper conclusion. So if you're like that as well and you think, oh God, because it's based on Douglas Adams, and Douglas Adams was a bit enigmatic, I guess is probably the word to go for with his writing. It's very kind of, oh, now we're here and now we're there and oh God. But actually, so I was very worried, but actually, stick with it. Season one is very confusing. The first episode is like a hammer to the brain. You have no idea what's going on, and it seems very random. But as the kind of the catch line of the show is, everything is connected. And I do thoroughly recommend it. Some very interesting characters and scenarios. Very, very funny. So yeah, go and check it out. Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. It's on Netflix, both seasons. So off you go.
Okay then.
And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.